What a blessing to have a real God who didn't send us a book to talk about Him. He sent us a love letter for fellowship. And then He comes into our heart so He can court us, because He understood that love is preferable to instruction and commandment. Because the great thing about love is when you love somebody, what they ask you never seems like a commandment. It always seems like, ta-da, I was wondering what I could do. It would make our life smoother and better and put that sparkle in your eye and twinkle in your step. Riding off to Alaska on the back of a motorcycle, early October, love. Love does that. Only God's Spirit and presence could put such a thing inside of us. And if we discount His presence so that we can stay in charge of everything, because you know, you turn His voice loose and then He starts taking charge. And there's nothing worse than having God take charge when you have plans of your own. If your plans are to build the biggest church in the community, you don't want God in the midst of it, because you understand that the world hated Him then, and He said they would hate Him now. And you know His truth is going to be a confrontation to the flesh. So you understand that you're going to minimize the social interaction of what the flesh would like to have. You're going to minimize that, and you're going to raise the level of what the spiritual man needs. So it's like putting a sign over the door that says spiritual food. And that's the thing that the spirit man needs. But here's the thing. It is contradictory to the flesh, because what you're actually doing is feeding the spirit man inside to be stronger than the outside man. And the outside man likes his way. How many knows what whey is? It's a milk byproduct. Curds and whey. Along came the spider. Yeah. So little Miss Muffet. So you get that. But everybody wants their own way. So what He's talking to us about is, I want you to take up the cross and follow Me. And Christianity's left the cross a long ways behind. Because that's kind of an invitation to pain. Thank you, but we spend billions of dollars on Excedrin in this country because we're not into pain so much. This is my amen corner. Okay, let me face this way. Good spot, that's right. So, Tom's going to dinner with me afterwards. And he's bringing the twins with him. But you guys, this is the thing that God is doing to us, is that He is reminding us that love is really, is not afraid of those things. Love isn't afraid of anything when you feel that presence of God. Love, perfect love casts out fear. So it's interesting, because I've met people who love to climb rock faces of mountains straight up. They love it. They love it. And when you love it, the higher you get, the better you feel. See, it works just the opposite on me. The higher I get, the less good I feel. And then there's a place that I would definitely turn around and slide down if I wouldn't die doing it. But when you love doing something, you love doing it. And you guys, those people that love doing that are the ones that are always in the pictures hanging from some rock thing. I would not drive a pinion into a rock and hang a bed thing on it and go to sleep 1,000 feet above the ground being held in by that little pinion, because I'd hear, and I'd go, did you hear that? Uh-huh, don't move. No, you're moving. I said, don't move. Then you realize you have to kill the person, because they're going to keep moving, because there is a thing, and you don't want it to move because this thing is rocking loose, and your brain tells you we're going to plummet. 1,000 feet to our death, and people are going to find us already encapsulated in this little nylon thing buried about 4 feet in the ground. They're probably just going to put dirt over us because they don't want to dig up and see what it was or who it was. Loving something. And that's what God said. I'm going to tell you something about my relationship. Take up your cross and follow me. And if that makes your mind stagger, then you don't love me yet. Come at it from this point. It's like, you know what, God, I don't think I love you enough to take up my cross and follow you. But I would like to love you that much. And you guys, what he does typically is sends us somebody into our life and we love them that much. And then we think, wow, isn't love grand? And then you think, love is an invincible thing. I'm just telling you, love is an invincible thing. Campbell Morgan talks about a violent act of a mother grabbing her child in front of a train. She saw the train coming, saw her child on the tracks, and she drew a correlation between whether or not she could make it to that little tyke or not. And she ran like the wind. And just as the train got to that child, she grabbed him by the arm and swung him around. She would never swing him like that. She'd never swing him like that, except that day, at that moment, because she wouldn't even let the train touch him. And the only thing she could do is grab him hard enough to get him out of the way. When I first moved here, that railroad track trestle that crosses by Lawrence over the river, 3 kids were on it. One of them was 5 years old. As they were nearly at the north end, they heard a train. And they turn around. They're almost to the north end, but because the train is coming from that direction, they run the length of the trestle. The littlest one ran the length of the trestle. 2 of them jumped out of the way because they were above before they could get off. And this little tried all he could to outrun that train. And you can imagine what an engineer would think in that train, because he comes around the corner and there's a little tyke running as hard as he can for the edge, and he knows you will never make it. I can't stop this train and you will never make it. You guys, these cataclysmic moments in our mind are just like that. And that's what God saw about your life and mine. You can't outrun the train. As much as you'd like to be a better person, you can't outrun the train. What it takes is the transforming power of God. What that little type needed was a mother that could grab him and get him off the way of that train. Lay him down in the track. Everything you would never think of were the only possibilities that little tyke had. But you guys, where we are, is there's the sound of a train. And you have to have information you don't possess of yourself on how to get out of what's happening on our earth. And so God has brought a salvation message to the church. And that salvation isn't just about being born again. Salvation is about being saved. Saved from yourself, saved from your enemies, safe from the processes of the things going on around you, and thinking that is becoming upside down. I can't describe it any better than that. The thinking is becoming upside down. So on Friday night, I was thinking of how precious it is, the love of God. You guys, when he talks to us in the most loving terms. He expressed his understanding for our need and then told us how to satisfy that need. He said, you're filled with sin. You can't have a relationship with me. And I long to have a relationship with you. But we can't. I've tried to have relationships with people who were addicted, deeply addicted to drugs. When I was in Vietnam, there was a man came to the Bible studies for a while. He was a mechanic on the engines that were the generators that made the electricity for our compound. And he was strung out on cocaine, seriously strung out. And to have a relationship with him was just glimpses. It was just a moment of lucidity in the middle of this obscuration of his brain, of his thinking. And he would be a really great friend when he was there. And then he would become unreasonable in his thought process when he was loaded with cocaine. And he came to me and said, I'm getting ready to go on R&R. He said, I've applied. So he said, I have a date, a time that they've set up. And he said, I'm not going to pass the UA. I need you to help me. I need someone that I can trust to go with me through this coming out of this cold turkey. And you guys, that man got so sick, I thought he would die. He sweat. He didn't sleep. To see these talons of torment on his mind that were literally tearing his thought process apart. I came back to the hooch. I went and got some stuff to calm his fever and to bring him something to drink. He was dehydrating. And he was gone. And I tried to find him, and somebody came running across the compound from 101st Airborne from their part. And that's where they sold, a lot of the drugs are sold up at the 101st Airborne. And he said, Raceley, he said, he's looking for you. And in his mind, you've done something to him. And he said, he can't explain it, but he's going to kill you. He's going to kill you. And you guys, this is a very real thing that was going on in this man. So that's what God is talking about. When my carnal mind, which wants to be a king, wants authority over my life, wants to do what it wants to do, it's a terrible battle that goes on inside of you and I. And when it's made worse by what the devil offers, because what Satan offers is a moment of peace from a tormented world at a high cost. At a high cost. He was paying $3 a vial for 90% better, pure heroin in Vietnam. Coke and heroin. $3 a vial. You could buy it along the Highway 1. Thing is, in the United States, it would be over $100 a day habit. So what he was doing is living on a $3 a day habit, which was almost nothing, but he couldn't come home. A lot of MIAs were just people who blended into the countryside because they could never come back home and feed that appetite inside of them. And it locked them in into a prison they couldn't get out of. And that's what Satan does. I've never seen an addiction that leaves you alone. Sorry, I've just never seen an addiction that'll leave you alone. Drinking don't leave you alone. It's always pretty parties on the beach and volleyball. Pretty girls, tanned. Buff guys, bouncing volleyballs, drinking Bud. They never show you the flop hotels on Skid Row. They never show you a 60-year-old woman looks 90, worn out, frequenting bars, looking for a friend. They never show you that. I had two aunts that were alcoholics. I'm telling you, they lived in the Cockroach Hotel. They lived in an old apartment house in Denver, not far off Larimer Street in the days when it was the wino section of Denver. My dad had been down there and witnessed to the people on the streets that lived on the streets, who had homes, who had jobs. Some were doctors, some were influential businessmen, and they just, something inside of their addiction wouldn't let them stop. And they knew better than to keep going. They were going the way they were going because they understood that they were losing everything that was important. But ultimately, it shifted to that being the most important thing. So Jesus came and said, listen, I'm going to be honest with you about relationship, and that is that I'm going to offer you a cross. And the thing is, it's going to loom very large and very real in your future if you accept it as my premise. Take up your cross and follow me. So what I'm offering you, not a world filled with easy things, but what I'm offering you is a realistic relationship that could only be based on love. In order to face my invitation, you would have to love me more than you love you. And the reason I know that is because I faced a cross in my life, and I loved you more than I loved me. So that when I came to Gethsemane, and I could have escaped, I could have went out the other side of the garden when the throng came to get me. I knew they were coming for me. I could have escaped. But I chose the cross because I loved you enough to choose the cross. So what I want to do is show you that love will get you there. Christianity isn't for the faint-hearted. It is for only those people who have a love relationship with Christ. And that's what he wants. Because when he created Adam, he created a son. He wanted a home. And he allowed men to build a temple for him. And he said, who's going to build a temple for me? The heavens can't hold me. And you're going to build me a temple? What? You're going to put huge columns on it? You're going to overlay things with gold? You're impressed with that? I'm not impressed with that. I made the gold. I could say, poof, make a mountain, and it would all been gold. I could have diminished the value of your gold instantly by making more than the world could ever need. I could have made it like dust. But I use it as an example of purification, because the more you put the fire to gold ore filled with rocks and impurities, the more pure it becomes. So he gave us this book of songs. And he's a loving God. But you guys, the thing I found is I love him. It makes this narrow road seem like a wide open latitude of liberty. It makes the cross seem like an elevator on my way home. I live on a floor too high to reach, and here's this elevator. It's not about dying to the things that are valuable. It's about dying to the things that would hold me earthbound. It's about setting me free so that I can fly. And that's what I want. I love that sense of being absolutely free. I love to be alone in the clouds. I love to fly in the evening shadows as it begins to set and look at the transforming of light as it comes dark across the earth at 10 or 12, 14,000 feet in a small plane. I love that sense of being able to fly. But that's what God gave the church. He gave us the ability to fly. He gave us wings. The ability to get above the things that earth bound us. So I'd like to start just with two songs that God sang himself. So I'm going to go to the book of Psalms, which is songs. Clever of me to know where the songs were in the Bible. And I want to sing a song that David sang. For the Messiah. The song he sang, having gone into and through this place where he felt forsaken by God. And in the midst of this sense of feeling forsaken, this mind-numbing emotional thing he was going through, he writes a song and begins to play, sets at his harp. And his fingers begin to touch the strings. And out of him, this song begins to come. I want to go to Psalms 22. Now, the songs we sang this morning were all precious songs. I enjoy every one of them. I enjoy the relationship with God. But I remember Jack Coe's sermon on vinyl. God will burn your barley fields. And my uncle put that needle down on that vinyl circulating disc. And made that little scratchy noise that the old vinyl made. Out of the speakers came Jack Coe's voice singing, "Though God slay me, yet will I trust him." And that song starts, "I can feel the hand of Satan as the tempter pressed me sore. He has been before the Father, asking leave to press me more. Though God slay me, yet will I trust him. I shall then come forth as gold, for I know my Redeemer liveth." So we don't sing that song much anymore. Our songs are avoidance. We avoid pain if we can. Our doctrines are avoidance. But the thing that God does is he's not about a God of avoidance. What he wants to do is to make you understand, you're going to have to love me, you know. If you love me enough, you're going to try and outrun the train. You're going to see somebody on the track and you're going to realize that child is too important to me. And my mind tells me I can't, but I have to go. I have to try. I can't stand at the side of the tracks and scream helplessly. I have to put in motion my sense of urgency. And you guys, that's what the church hasn't done. Because we haven't lost our sense of our life, we haven't brought to the table those things that are eternally important. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me? and from the words of my roaring. An ordinary man in an extraordinary event, singing an impossible song. He's turned this agony into a song. Oh my God, I cry in the daytime. This soldier, invincible, this general, high in the Israeli command, a man of renown. Women sang his praises when he came back from battle because he was triumphant in battle. David had killed his 10,000s. And they mentioned Saul, the king. He'd killed his thousands. And that started a war between the heart of Saul and the general David. He's just a young man. But he had a heart invincible because he believed that things of value should be defended without thought of life. His dad left him sheep, and he loved his dad. I mean, he loved his dad. And he saw himself on this hillside with those sheep under the commission of his dad, who said, David, you can take the sheep now. I've been waiting for this. I keep telling my dad, Dad, I'm big enough to keep the sheep. I'm big enough. Because, you know, it's only just watching sheep, right? And everybody knows the sheep are fun to watch. What his dad knew and his older brothers knew is that there were lions. That's problematic for sheep. And there were bears. That's problematic for sheep. So it wasn't, could you watch the sheep? Everybody knew David could watch the sheep, but he had a heart of gold. But he wasn't just going to watch the sheep. Because when that little tyke got out there, he told himself, my dad trusted me with these sheep. His sheep. That makes him my watch. And along came a lion. And David practiced every single day because he was a man who anticipated, a boy who anticipated the inevitable, yes? Because in his mind he understood that there was problems out there. He didn't live in a Pollyanna view that these sheep would outrun the lion. And he had a slingshot. And so every day he practiced with his slingshot because the whole idea is, you'd have to hit a lion really hard. You'd have to hit him really square to send him a message. And so he was a man who set in motion those things that would bring about the highest probability of success at the job God had given him. Wow, that's what love does. And he took that probability of one day a lion coming by, and he practiced until he was kind of waiting on lions. Like, I'd like to have a lion come by. And so he would watch really, really careful, thinking, surely a lion would want to come by. I don't know if he didn't bring parts of dead lambs out there to bring them up. I don't know. But he was ready. You've had those kind of things happen in your life. But you anticipate that thing that you suddenly are capable of doing, and there it is. And you're so glad that you can do it. That these two things have come to the exact place at the exact same time. Your bravery, your courage, your anticipation and your preparation. And this thing that was going to need you there to stop what was going on. Because that's what the church is like. So you can't sit down and sing a song like this unless you believe there's a hope beyond what you're feeling. My God, why have you forsaken me? If God feels like you are forsaken by God, what do you do next with your song? Who are you singing to? I cry in the daytime. This man who is invincible, this man who put fear in the hearts of whole countries. This man, when he was old, could scare the daylights out of the Israeli army. And if you want to have an army that is pretty much at the top of the list of things not to mess with, the Israeli army is way up there on that list. Because they practice for the inevitable. They believe they live in a rough neighborhood, they call it. They will tell you, we live in a rough neighborhood, and we accept that we live in a rough neighborhood, but we've learned that we have to protect ourselves. Now here's the thing about what God is doing. Why would the God who made the whole earth give them a piece of ground? And because God gave it to them, Satan hates them for having that ground. And there's this boast that is politically made around the world. We're going to take that little piece of ground away from them. Are you kidding me? The point is, the problem exists because God has given promise. Now, if God gives promise and that little piece of ground becomes the torment of the whole world, because everybody believes, honestly, politically right now, people believe that World War III is going to start right there. So here's the issue. They've prepared, but they can only prepare so much. They need a miracle from God. You need a miracle from God. When you see that you need something from God, that's where you go, is go to God. So when David felt this way, he sings this song because songs are a blessing. Saul, who has now been turned into this man named Paul, and his friend Silas have been arrested and beaten because they wouldn't let people sacrifice to him. Right? They healed this man. And everybody went berserk. They saw a miracle. They actually saw a real, living miracle. And now they're going to make these two men Zeus and Mars, or Jupiter and Mars or something. And so the gods have come down among us, they said. And Paul tears his clothes and begs, you can't worship me. You can't worship me. I'm just a man. God did this. This man was healed in the name of Jesus. You can't worship me. Well, then now they're really disturbed because their religion has been debased. And he goes immediately from being worshipped to being killed. Am I right? So you see in this just single sentence structure that he goes from being worshipped to being killed. That's the way it works. And they take Paul in another place and they do the same thing to him. So Barnabas and Silas both learn something about traveling with Paul. The man can't even heal somebody and not get you in trouble. So he gets into trouble in this other place and they bring him up before the magistrates and they cast him into the dungeon. They beat them. And I know Silas could be discouraged. It's like, Paul, buddy, I've preached the gospel places. I've done lots of things, but I haven't been abused like I've been abused since I've been traveling with you. I'm coming to this conclusion that traveling with you actually is like a lightning rod of stuff going on. So I'm thinking that Barnabas and I are going to go with John Mark next time. And you guys, you didn't read about them getting into trouble? Yeah. I think Barnabas thought, I think I've made the right choice. But here's what God does. When God does what He really does, it makes the world stir up. Because everywhere you are, there's a religious entity that's being threatened by truth. And today we have something unique because the human nature has decided that man is God. And that we are really smart. And then we've got an additional thing to it, and that's that we all own computers, and the computer can outthink any man, practically. And that's what they call it, is artificial intelligence. Yes? Artificial intelligence. That's what I had in school. I didn't think like a computer, but it was certainly artificial. But you guys, here's what's interesting, is that that's the reason that the Macintosh has a bite out of the apple. Jobs thought, well, this is a joke. We've taken a bite out of the apple. We're not afraid of wisdom. We're not afraid of intelligence. God wasn't afraid of intelligence, you moron. He's smarter than everybody. He wanted you to understand this stuff. You think you figured out how to do ... and made a computer out of the thing? God gave us this intelligence. God brings this information. God knows how to open the mind and give information to it. Men like the credit for it. But God's the one who gave us the information. And that's the thing that God is doing to us, is He's separating us fact from fiction. But the world is coming to this place where humanism solves problems. The whole world is becoming under this dominion of the intellect of man. So we've elevated man to God status. And even the pagans were smart enough not to make man their God. Because when you need rain, they understood they weren't smart enough to know how to make rain. so they had a rain god. And then they knew they couldn't make the sun come back out, so they had a sun god. They at least knew to worship the things that they needed and to glorify something bigger than themselves. So now we have man doing it, but the great thing is God is still above it all. And what you and I recognize is that we're coming to a time that man's going to solve the problem, because the Bible said that the beast solved the problems. He didn't make the problems worse, he solved them. He solved the financial problems. The Bible said the writer would come with the balances in his hands, trying to make things balanced out. So the Bible tells us that the day is coming that you can't buy or sell without a name or a number of the image. And that's a great fix. Because if you have to prove where you got your money and it can only go through a numbered system into something that gives you credit for what it is, you can't take $20 bills down to the bank that you got at the bank, at the drug sale. You can't have $20 bills. The only thing you can spend is what you've got in an account that's been set up by somebody, and you transfer what you're worth at what you do into that account, and you get that amount, and that's how it works. You can't buy and you can't sell unless you have that number. So you have been limited in how you could do anything illegal. You can't even get around taxes. See how my tie hangs down when I do that? So the Bible foretold that the day would come when men would fix the problems. Because, you guys, one of the problems with the gang wars is money. You see, there's this battle going on where men buy bigger and bigger guns because they want control of what's going through the hands of people by the tens of thousands of dollars a day. And if they couldn't buy it, they couldn't sell it, and they couldn't spend it, you would stop the drug traffic wars. So you see, what happens is man's going to come up with this solution that God foretold in the Bible, and they're going to say, hey, look, we're going to fix this stuff. And the Bible said the whole world's going to be glad that this stuff is fixed. So it's going to be an unprecedented time of peace. What the world is looking for right now is that we're going into Armageddon and all the chaos and all the turmoil, but the Bible said that the beast was going to bring these things under dominion, and all the world is going to wonder how he fixed stuff. So what God is telling us is that, but you can't take the number. Because it's a sellout. It says you believe that man is your answer. And I'm your answer. And I'm looking for faith on the earth. Faith in me. Faith in me. And so I'm testing you. I'm showing you. I'm leading you through these tough things. I want your song to be a song because you realize the God who loves me is bringing me through these tough things because he wants me to be sufficient in him. He wants me to believe that he is the one that brings me the manna from heaven. He can feed me supernaturally when there is no job. Because that's what God has promised to his people. I'll take care of you like I did the children of Israel in the wilderness. I promise you that I will take care of you. You come to me. You trust in me. You lean on me. I will meet your needs. And you guys, that's what God has made promise. But here's what our issues are. Our issues are being able to believe that. Look what he says here. Oh my God, I cry in the daytime. Verse 2, but thou hearest not, and in the night season, and I am not silent. I'm crying, you're silent. I'm begging, you seem to be too distant to hear what I'm saying. Is God putting him through this? Sure, absolutely, God's putting him through this. Why is that? Because he's still there. The point is, yes, you're going through this. That's why the psalmist David would sing it as a song. Because he's putting out before God what he feels like. But this is a prophecy for what Jesus felt on the cross. He's running parallel to the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. And so 1,000 years before he's going to be crucified, the psalmist David sits down and begins to feel these personal things going on in his life. And he feels the depth of what Jesus is going to feel on the cross. And he begins to sing this song of songs. This is a song. This is worship. This is praise. Because I don't feel you and you're silent and I wish you weren't. Everything in me is begging you, please don't be silent now and you're silent. And I'm sorry that you are. Because I need you now more than I've ever needed you before. And God was going to say this. You think that God does this only to men? God came and allowed this to happen to him, to God. And he knew it was coming. And hanging on that cross and pressing against the nails so that he could exhale, so he could breathe in. And he's beaten beyond recognition, and he's hated by the very people that he loved. When you are hated by your own, he came to his own, and his own received him not. You guys, there's something about your life that you have something, you have some people, you have somebody, that when everything seems to go against you, you know that you could go back. And just for a minute, they would wrap you up in their arms and they would make you feel safe. And you would know there was a genuine love between you and them that would bring you to a place that would make you know, I'm taken care of here. And when you find that kind of place, that's where you go. That's where you retreat. That's what you, those are the arms you go back to. That's the friends you seek. If you only have one friend in town that's like that, when you go through something like this, you're at his door. And can I just come in? It's like, well, look at you. Sure, come in. Sit down. And then they're right beside you. They sit right down beside you. And they're just silent. They don't have to offer you anything. They are there. And you've come because they are them. And because I found this place that I can roll up like a little tyke and just waste away in this moment, and you will hold me so I don't disappear. So I don't just disappear. I feel like I'm disappearing. I feel like I've been written with ink that disappears. Hold me, please. Keep me real. The Velveteen Rabbit is about that. Steve Highlander, crippled kid, came to one of my meetings out in McCook, Nebraska. We became friends. And he had this book, The Velveteen Rabbit, and he gave it to me. And in this toy room, there's this rabbit, and all of its hair has been worn off. And everybody else feels superior to the Velveteen Rabbit. But he said, actually, no, because they loved me enough to hold me. I've been held so much that my hair has been worn off. Wow. That's what made me real. And you guys, there's some places in our life we absolutely have to find somebody that really is a sanctuary. That's what God called himself. That's why this is called a sanctuary. I don't call it a sanctuary because it's a nice little building that's partially underground. If a storm comes, this is a good place to go. Because actually I've counted the windows in here and it doesn't seem like it'd be all that great. But it's a sanctuary because God is my sanctuary. And because when I feel like singing these kinds of songs or saying these kinds of things, I don't just say them. I don't say them as though it's a tragedy happening to me. I've learned a long time ago that when these things begin to come my way, I just pick up my guitar. And I just begin to pick at those strings, one string at a time. Well, my ravens didn't show up this morning. When I wrote that, my ravens didn't show up. My ravens didn't show up. And the brook where I've been drinking has gone dry. The brook had gone dry. And God was leading me somewhere out of that comfort zone of what had been into a place I wasn't certain where it was going to be, but he was still him. It was where I was going because of who he was. I learned to curl up in the safety of the reality of him being there, even when I didn't feel he was there. This invisible God was always visible. And I could always curl up. And when my carnal mind said he's not even hearing, what I was saying is, I don't feel different. I'm asking him, medicate me. Medicate me. This thing is hurting me. You fix this. You change this. You do something in me. And what I learned was to sing it. Take this and sit down. Jesus loved me so much that he just could not walk past me. And I could see him absolutely spotless and white. And there I am in the miry clay. And I'm stuck. And when you're out in that and you're stuck, you understand that this person standing there is going to get really, really dirty getting you out. That he just could not walk past me. Why? Because he loved me too much. And he had to reach his hands down and pull me from the miry clay. And like the woman at the well side, he stopped to shine his love around me. And like the woman at the well, his love was just what I was looking for. And you guys, when you find love, it doesn't have to be told to you. Love is a sanctuary of itself. That's why you find someone in your life and you realize this is that genuine love. This is that love that doesn't go away. It's this love that keeps me. And I don't have to ask. I don't have to test it. I don't have to push to see if it's there. It's really there. That's what love is about. It's about the depth of Him bringing us to a place like that. As only He could bring us to it. I'm crying. You're not hearing. Verse 3 says, but you're holy, O thou that inhabitest the praises of Israel. You live where? Yeah, you live where I praise. Well, that's clever. I'm going through a tough time. I need you. So it's like, I create where you live. I make where you live. Not by just crying out, help me. But I make where you live because I praise you. And there you are. Because when I shift my thinking from defeat to praise, something begins to take place in me called faith. And God brings me to that believing that is genuinely Him. Our fathers trusted in you and were delivered. Your reputation. I don't feel you, but I know your reputation. And I know you're faithful. I know who you are. You guys, how many of us know who God's love is, who God is, who Christ is in our life? So that we get into the turmoil and the devil starts telling us, or our flesh starts telling us, hey, well, he didn't show up. He's not here. He's not talking. He's not. The pain's still there. The medication didn't arrive. But he does. And this is the issue about this sense of relationship is that I know his reputation. And if he's allowing me to go through these tough things, he's allowing me to go through it because he has a reason for me to go through it. What was David's reason for going through this? So that he could sing this song. So that this far in front of the cross of Calvary, the diary of Jesus, the mind of Christ, you can open up the book of Psalms and you're immersed in the diary of what he thought while he walked on the earth. That's why it's the biggest book in the Bible. That's why it always brings you peace. Because when you get inside his mind, you get what he's thinking. And when your thoughts turn like his thoughts, it brings you to the same conclusion that brought him. And that was peace. And that's what the Spirit of God does in a man. So that's what Jesus was doing. And that's how come he walked a successful walk, because he did that. And people say, yes, but he talks about sin. Oh, yeah. Because sin was dumped on him. Our sin was dumped on him. He felt the guilt of sin. He felt this wickedness against him. And he came to that place of understanding that God would bring him through these things. Our fathers trusted in thee. They trusted and you delivered them. They cried unto you and were delivered. They trusted in you and were not confounded. Now, we've talked about this lots of times. This song goes from absolute focus on what he is to the despair of what I feel. So verse 6 says, but I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men and despised of the people. This is what he's seeing. This is what he's feeling. And the success of his life was ministry. Am I right? That men would know he taught the truth so that they could have salvation, because he offered them salvation. But what good is an offering of help if people don't believe it's real? And hanging on this cross, it appears as though it isn't real, because they said, you said you could save others. You can't even save yourself. All they that see me laugh me to scorn. They shoot out the lip. They shake the head, saying, he trusted on the Lord. That he would deliver him, let him deliver him, seeing he delighted in him. Then verse 9, he gets his mind off what's being said and what he feels, goes back. But you are he that took me out of the womb. Now the song has a different beat to it. There's just a different, there's this up, there's this down, there's the minors, there's the harmonies that come together. And all these things are working to make this song a song. But you are he that took me out of the womb. You did make me hope when I was upon my mother's breast. Both David felt it and Jesus would feel it. I was cast upon you from the womb. You are my God from my mother's belly. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there's none to help. Now he's just saying, don't be far from me. Stay by me. Many bulls have compassed, these strong bulls of Bashan have beset me round. They gaped upon me with their mouths as a ravening and a roaring lion. I'm poured out like water. And he was indeed. David wouldn't know that the prophecy was so real that a soldier would take a spear and pierce the side of Jesus. And all my bones are out of joint, crucifixion. My heart's like wax. It is melted in the midst of my bowels. And that's because he's dehydrated beyond any possible recovery. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaveth to my jaws, and you have brought me to the dust of death, but not to it. I'm not dead. I'm dying. I can't think of anything worse than being hopelessly lost in sin and having no hope of death. Because you wouldn't want to live like that. Sin don't give you peace. It vexes you out of your mind. People that live in the world honestly find the thought that they would die soon to be a relief to them. That's why suicide is pandemic. Am I right? Sin without hope. If the only hope you would have would be death, that I would just leave this body, I would leave this sinning, tormented body, I could get out of here and go someplace else. Any place else besides my thinking process. And when you die, you take it all with you. You take your soul with you. And pain is the same way. There are people in so much pain, they would be glad to die. The thought of being able to step from this world into the next becomes a very real relief. I can't think of anything worse than those two things without death. Locked in a life of sin and deprivation. Or in agonizing pain. But to a believer, that isn't what death is about. For dogs have compassed me. The assembly of the wicked have enclosed me. They pierced my hands and feet. David's song has taken on a prophetic turn. They've pierced my hands and my feet. I may tell all my bones, they look and stare upon me. Because he's hanging naked. They part my garments among them and cast lots for my vesture. Indeed they did. David's song is birthed in the very furnace of affliction. He has no way to know what it is that he's singing this song about. But be not thou far from me, O Lord, O my strength. Haste thee to deliver me. Deliver my soul from the sword, my darling from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth, for you have heard me from the horns of the unicorn. I will deliver thy name. I will declare thy name unto my brethren. In the midst of the congregation will I praise thee. That's upbeat. The song has now taken on a completely different dynamic. I'm going to be okay. Not only am I going to be okay, but I'm going to preach your name. I'm going to deliver your hope. I'm going to bring to others this that I'm gathering right now. In the midst of the congregation will I praise thee. Ye that fear the Lord, praise him. Decidedly different thought in the song. All ye the seed of Jacob, glorify him and fear him. All ye the seed of Israel. For he hath not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted. He catches your tears in a bottle, he said. In your affliction, he's afflicted. He goes with us through these things. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we're not alone in the furnace. Daniel wasn't alone in the lion's den. They weren't alone in Babylon. Joseph wasn't alone in the dungeon, and Moses wasn't alone in the palace. Nor was he alone in the wilderness. That's because God goes with us and keeps us and sustains us. And that's what we're learning about this God who's calling us to this place. Listen. For he hath not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted. There are people that act like that God hates people who are afflicted. Hates people that haven't overcome the things that they're going through. As though it's your responsibility to overcome the things you're going through. There's all kinds of religious thought like that right now. And the truth is, he said, God doesn't despise that. He's bringing you through it. He hath hid his face from him. Neither hath he hid his face from him, but when he cried unto him, he heard. Now, earlier he said, I cried and you didn't hear me. Now he's bringing us back in this place. It's like actually when they cried, you heard. My praise shall be of thee in the great congregation. I will pay my vows before them that fear him. The meek shall eat and be satisfied. This is no longer exhaling to survive. This is about that crescendo of the Spirit of God's presence, because he does inhabit praise, yes? And now he's built the house of praise. And God indeed has inhabited it. And these changes that are taking place in the very being of this man still hanging on the cross has trended to victory. In the living, in the dying, in the trusting of God, it's about a sense of believing. He says this, all the ends of the world shall remember and turn unto the Lord. All and all the kindreds of the nations shall worship before thee. For the kingdom is the Lord's, and he is the governor among the nations. All they that be fat upon the earth shall eat and worship. All they that go down to the dust shall bow before him, and none can keep alive his own soul. A seed shall serve him. It shall be accounted to the Lord for a generation. They shall come and shall declare his righteousness unto a people that shall be born, that he hath done this. You and I are learning these songs. You and I are writing these songs. God is bringing us through the things that affect us so that we can come into these places uninitiated and learn to praise. Learn to create that habitation, that sense of, if I create this habitation of praise, I will come into it and he will come into it and we'll meet there together. I want to go back real quick to Genesis, famous portion of scripture, real quick. And Genesis 18, we are all aware this is Abraham's moment with God, when he appears in the flesh and comes to talk to him. Abraham has left Ur of the Chaldees and followed this God who was a voice. And now, here in this particular portion of scripture, God comes to visit him in the flesh. And Abraham recognizes who it is. And the Lord appeared unto him. I want to read with verse 1. Because between verse 1 and verse 15, what we're dealing with is this great promise that Sarah's going to have a baby. This is good news indeed, because he's already been told she's going to have a baby. But this is the news that tells you when. This is like looking up on the internet to find out where your package is. And who doesn't know that feels good? It's like, well, you told me it was coming, but I guess you meant later. And the Lord appeared unto him in the plains of Mamre, and he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day. Hot tent, too hot to sit in. Sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day. And he lifted up his eyes and looked, and lo, three men stood by him. And when he saw them, he ran to meet them from the tent door and bowed himself toward the ground. He's got company that he recognizes is about God's business. And he said, my Lord, if now I have found favor in thy sight, pass not away, I pray thee, from thy servant. Let a little water, I pray you, be fetched, and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree. This man is the friend of God. Come. Don't go away. Stay for a minute. You and me, we're here together. I'll wash your feet. Let me get some water. I'll wash your feet. I know you're tired. I know you're hot. This is Abraham. And he's old. Yeah? The Lord is young. Come on. He didn't pick an old body. He didn't come limping down the road. He's running around in here, like, wow. And Abraham, the old man, gets up. It's like, wow, I got to get water to wash your feet. What a heart of relationship. You're my guest. Please stay a minute with me. Linger with me a minute. you've had people that you wish would linger a minute. When my mom and my aunt had attended the funeral of their mother, my grandmother, out at the great congregational church next to her house, the big stone church. Evening had come, and they'd had lunch, and my mother now is going home alone. Everybody's left. My aunt has a husband and a son and some grandkids living in her house. And my mother says to her sister, Irene, why don't you go with me and we'll go to the bar and have a drink? And that's because I knew she was going home alone. And my aunt is just thinking about getting home because they've buried their mother. And both of them are feeling that empty loneliness that can only happen after 90-some years. By that time, you think she's going to be here forever. Now she's gone. And this is the first evening that she's been in the grave. And now all these things are done. And I could see this moment. And my mom wanted Irene to stay. Don't leave. Linger with me. That's how I see Abraham. You're here. I need you. Don't go. Let me fetch some water. I'll wash your feet. Stay a minute with me. You guys, that's how precious God is. That's why it is Friday night sometimes. When the Spirit and presence of God comes in this place. And I can feel Him like that. And the first thing I tell Him is, stay. Stay a while. Stay a while. God, how I feel right now in You, with You, I don't want You to leave. Just stay with us a while. Because you guys, I know He's with us all the time. But that presence that makes me feel His arm around me, that makes me feel that actual presence of God, it's like, no, stay with me. Don't leave. And you guys, what happens is we all begin to draw together. Because we can all feel that same thing. It's like, wow, I feel this presence of God. And the great thing about God is that He releases tears in us, because tears are a cleansing process. There's something about tears that help let things escape. It's like on a hot water heater, it's got a valve on the top of it that if something breaks in your hot water heater and the thermostat doesn't shut off, that thing will be a bomb. It'll send the top of your house off somewhere far, far away. And send boards to your neighbor's yard and beyond and break windows. I mean, everybody loves a hot water heater, but it's a bomb. You can't heat that thing super hot. Make it turn to steam inside and not let it loose. So there's this valve on the top that busts, and it just lets the steam out. And as long as that hot water heater's heating, it'll let out the steam. That's a great idea. And that's what your tears are like. You have things going on in your life. Sorrow sinks you down. Tears come out of your eyes. That's because something inside of you begs for a release. Let me take the things that I'm feeling and release them. And it does the same thing with that incredible joy that happens to us when God's Spirit and presence comes and touches us. Because there's something so loving about God. We just can't stop. It's like the longer you linger by me, the more I feel. You guys, I have seen grown men try to discreetly wipe from their eyes their tears. I was doing a funeral or a wedding, excuse me, when I first came to Kansas and to that great big Methodist church on the byway in Overland Park and in Prairie Village, excuse me. And the woman that asked me to do the wedding, the Methodist preacher had to, of course, be part of the wedding because it was his church. And then I came in, and then he takes one look at me and says, no, you'll have to wear that black robe. And we're doing a practice, and I know there's a whole bunch of people from the church that were there, and I knew when I walked out on that platform in that black robe, there was going to be frolicking in the crowd. And I thought, better to get it over today while we're practicing. Good that you came. But in the real wedding, you guys, I turned to this man who was marrying this woman. And he was in his late 50s. Very wealthy man. And he loved her, and he'd loved her for years. Finally, he's convinced her that he's the man of her dreams. And the Spirit of God fell on that place. And he's crying so hard that finally, even the Methodist minister's looking around for something to help him because his handkerchief is full. And he's bewildered. This Methodist minister is really bewildered. It's like, I'm out of my comfort zone. I mean, this man is falling apart, and this is just a wedding. And then I turned to the bride, and the Spirit of God descended on her, and she began to cry out loud. And people could hear these two people crying under this presence of God. And that's what God does. What He does is He releases in us those things that we try to stay stoic. He's like, well, excuse me, I'm a man. And then God just touches your heart and just flips this button, and suddenly out of your eyes comes all of this sense of release. I have to release all of this. I need that release. I need God to do these things in me. That's the kind of God we serve. Was that cry because her arm hurts? Oh, sisters can do that. They shouldn't, but they could. But you guys, God releases those things. I've had that happen here at the church lots and lots of times. New people come. I remember some new guys that came with their girlfriend. Some girl invited them from the school. And they come and the Spirit of God falls on them in the song service and they're crying. And the girls are thinking. And the guys are thinking, hey, look at me. I'm washing his feet. I'm saying, don't go. Stay right here. Deal with me. Touch me more. I don't care what anybody sees right now. I am feeling this release inside of me. I couldn't have stopped it if I wanted to. It's the kind of God we serve. So Abraham is doing these very things. So God comes and tells him, Abraham, about this time next year, your wife's going to have a baby. Sarah's in the tent cooking. Don't you love that? Remember, it was so hot that Abraham was sitting on the outside. First time I visited Nigeria, this man was all excited to take me home to meet his mother. And he takes me to the house, and there's a nice house there, and out in back there's this mud hut thing, and it's got a chimney effect thing at the top, and smoke's coming out of it. And he said, my mother's in there drying fufu. I'm up for that. And so we go in there, and you guys, she's got this fire. Now, it's like 100 degrees and high humidity, you're sweltering. And you go in this place, and it's the same temperature in the room as it is under the fufu. And she's stirring it to get the moisture off this. She's pounded it. You guys, you burn 3 times the calories to make fufu into meal, so that by the time you eat it, you have lost 2/3 of the weight you would gain back eating the fufu. Nutrisystems ought to send you some fufu just as it's harvested. And a fufu pounder and instructions on making a mud hut and a place to stir it to get the moisture all off of it before you ever turn it into something that you can make into a thing. And then it's wet. And you stick your hands down in it because it's wet and gooey. And then you pick up the meat and you put it in your mouth and everybody else can't look. Because it's that bad to look at. So you realize, well, the first time I ate fufu and the meat and stuff together, it was in the dark. Blessed relief. Total pitch black darkness. I wouldn't have eaten it if Carl Schneider hadn't told everybody he was fasting. Quick thinking man. In the dark, they bring you plates of stuff. It's like, thank you, I'm fasting. He knew I was looking at him. As dark as it was, he knew I was looking at him. 3 times they fed us that night at 3 different places, and I'm telling you, every time he was fasting. Thing about God is, you guys, that He brings us into this sense of value of relationship. And this is what women did. They were in the kitchen. And she hears this prophecy. She's listening. That's what women always do. That's a great thing about owning a tent, right? If you move your wife into a tent, be certain you and your friends cannot say anything outside that she won't know. How many of you know that your wife wants the kitchen and the living room open? Do you know why? Oh yeah, I nailed you. So what he says is, here's the deal. Your wife's going to have a baby, and she laughs because they're old. And so she asked him, so you think we could have pleasure at our age? I like the way she asked that. I mean, is this too much information? And God takes it in stride. It's like, yes. La. Abraham's bouncing around. It's like he's... I mean, this is God's story. I'm not making this stuff up. This is the way God told the story. But Sarah's laughing, and God said, you laugh? Now, that's the problem with God. It's because she's laughing to herself, and God don't have to listen to the tent. He knows what we're doing. And so he tells her, why did Sarah laugh? She goes, oh, I didn't laugh. She lies to God. She lies to God. He still loves her. Because he knows she's caught in this place that she feels bad about what's going on. This emotion, this woman is having a time. But she's got the best news she could ever get. No. Then we transition. These three men leave, and Abraham goes with them. And they walk towards the road that overlooks Sodom in the valley from this mountain lofty position. And these two men walk on, and the Lord lingers with Abraham. And the Bible says that the Lord said, shouldn't I tell Abraham, my friend, what I'm getting ready to do? He's just come from this place where he's been told you're going to have the baby of your life, the time of your life is about to happen to you. This thing you've prayed for, wished for, hoped for, longed for is about to happen to you. But the sin of Sodom has brought me to this day. And I just got to tell you, I'm done. I'm going down. If Sodom is as bad as I am led to believe, I'm going to destroy it. Now, you guys, it's interesting because this old man, this old friend of this young God, are standing on a road overlooking a valley filled with people. Abraham has rescued these people in a battle. Kings came and took them away. And because his nephew Lot was among them, man, he gathered his army up and down he went. Boom! He destroys what these kings in the valley could never do. Abraham alone and his army does? Man, this guy travels with the Israeli army already. And he doesn't even know he's Hebrew yet. God said, I'm going to destroy it. And you guys, God and Abraham have this very poignant conversation. Because Abraham knows that Lot lives down there and that God is just in his judgment. And so he never asks for Lot. He never says, my nephew's down there. You and I would say that. My nephew Lot is there and his family. God, don't destroy them. Don't destroy Sodom with them in it. They're in Sodom. He doesn't say that. He said, Lord, surely you wouldn't destroy Sodom if there were 50 righteous. And he calls it righteous. Let me draw a line here between the holy and the profane. I'm not asking for Lot. I'm asking for a righteous people. Anyone righteous there. Save them out of it. And because you are the judge, if you judge him not to be righteous, I'm not asking you to save him out of it. If he's wicked, I've longed to hear how he's doing. He's lost everything. He's a very wealthy man. He owns so much stuff that they couldn't live together, he and Abraham. Their shepherds were fighting. Their flocks were too large. The ground was too small. And they've separated because of this great blessing of God on them. And now Lot has nothing. He lives in Sodom. But he has a intercessor on the mountain, somebody who's praying for him. So he asks God, you would surely save the righteous. Yes, and he goes from 50 to 10. Talking with God, God said, yeah, I wouldn't destroy the city if there were 50 righteous. There's not 50 righteous there. Gets down to 10, there were 10 righteous there. But when you read over in Peter, Peter describes Lot as a righteous man, vexed by the conversation, and the reason he can apply righteousness to him is because he didn't die in Sodom. And the intercession was for the righteous to come out. Yes? So what God does to you and me is He brings us to this place that He brings us to victory. Now, listen to me. This promise that his son is going to be born within a year, this man comes back the next day. Abraham comes back the next day, and he looks down at this valley. You can go with me over here. And the Bible said in chapter 19, I want to go over here to verse 29 or 27. Lot's wife looks back in verse 26. And becomes a pillar of salt. She's not going to be buried. God's bringing judgment. She could have come out and made a choice that was a choice to go back. And so God preserved it. It was like this promise that I would have brought her back. I'm going to turn her to a pillar of salt. She's not going to be buried. She's not going to be burned. I'm not going to burn her. But she's dead. So I'm going to make her into salt. Now listen. And Abraham got up early in the morning to the place where he stood before the Lord, where he and God looked over this valley. And he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the plain and beheld. And lo, the smoke of the country went up as the smoke of a furnace. You understand what heat does. When you see the heat of a furnace, there's smoke of things that are burning. But when you have something that is generating constant heat, it has that volume of hot air rising that changes the smoke. And you can see this intermingling of this power of the rising of the heat. And that's what Abraham's looking at. Now, he's just been told he's going to have a baby. And he's looking at a world under the judgment of a righteous God. And it's like, what about the future of Isaac? I mean, there wasn't 50 righteous there. And listen, he waited in the night. I can guarantee you he waited in the night to hear the sound of his family coming up the hill. Because those angels told Lot, flee to the mountain. Go home. God says you can go home now. And Abraham's waited in anticipation to know whether or not Lot's been delivered. He didn't go down to get him. After God talked to him, Abraham didn't cut a run down that hill to get to Lot before the fire came. He left it in the hands of the God he trusted. His song was like this song. His song was like Paul and Silas in the dungeon, singing the songs of glory, singing the songs of Zion. So important that none of the prisoners left when the earthquake shook the doors and opened the prison. They all came to those men to hear what they had to say. They wanted to hear the story of these men who could sing in a dungeon beaten. You guys, Christianity is not about the success that kept us from any pain. It's about the song in the night season. It's about the ability to sing when nothing in you should have a reason to sing. When the church comes to that foundation, when it can sing this song hanging on a cross and make it into a song and bring the fellowship divine, bring the praises into that place where we really are praising God because He's real. And what I feel is not as important as who He is. His reputation transcends what I feel. I'm begging for medication, but I am accepting the fact that He is sovereign over me. And that if He is leading me through this with no medication, then He knows what the outcome is that's better than what I would have known. Better than I would have known. And that's what you want. And that's what I want. And he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the plain and beheld. And lo, the smoke of the country went up as the smoke of a furnace. And it came to pass when God destroyed the cities of the plain that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in the which Lot dwelt. Lot went up to Zoar. You guys, Abraham trusted God. If Lot didn't come, then something else has happened to him. He didn't blink an eye. He never mentioned anything about God letting him down. We live on what we can see. Abraham lived on the reputation of a God he left Lot in the hands of. This is in your hands. If he's righteous, save him. If he's not, he's yours. Well, and when he doesn't see him, it doesn't diminish anything about his relationship with God. He doesn't say, "Why, God? You knew I loved him. Why wouldn't you bring him out of Sodom?" It's like, well, he's in Zoar. I don't know where Zoar is. Of course you don't. Nobody knows where Zoar is. The God who loves us brings us to such a place that our unshakable conviction is that he is a loving God. And that if I need something, he will provide it for me. He's that kind of God. And if I fail to understand it in the beginning, he leads me through these things because he knows the outcome is exactly what I know I need. And when I have come to believe in him and his gentleness, when I believe that he's more gentle than what I see anything around me to be, when I believe that he's kinder than what I could ever find fault with, when I believe that, then I've come to know him. And that's the kind of relationship we need. We need that relationship with God that has that reality to it, that puts us in a place that it doesn't matter how we feel, up, down, indifferent. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're going through tough stuff and God could have brought the medicine. Is that he is the medicine. And my confidence in him is the medicine. And I can guarantee you, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, well, the God we serve is able to deliver us. But if he does not, he's able to deliver us. But if he does not, we are not bowing to you. We have consolation in him. We have comfort in him. We love him and he loves us. And because of that love, I'm not going to stand before him and have his eyes look at me with such disappointment. If you'd have just stood. If you'd have just stood and they threw you in the furnace, I was coming into the furnace. I had this great opportunity to just get in the furnace with you, and Nebuchadnezzar was going to have to get up and admit I was God. I ain't facing him with that. I'm not going to be the weak link that lets him down and then he weeps. Because nobody loved him enough to stand in that place. The Bible said God's looking for faith. He said, will he find faith on the earth when he returns? You and I, that's what we want. God, I want faith for you. I want faith in who you are, irregardless of what I feel or think or what's going on around me. You are that God. Let's stand together.